So the way cartels are operating in Mexico right now is unprecedented. We haven't seen something like this before, where they are literally controlling everything and everyone, which is why the U.S. is sanctioning so many Mexican politicians. And that's also a first, seeing so 50 go down at once from the municipal level to the federal level. And that certainly is sending a message. And in my opinion, when you have politicians who are on the payroll, it's worse than the very criminals who are inflicting violence against communities. The politicians are the ones who, like we talked about previously, are supposed to uphold integrity and implement policy that protects citizens, not allows them to be terrorized at every waking moment.
Hey, gang. We're back for part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Still talking to Katarina Schulz. And I hope I'm saying your name right.
Yeah, great job.
Good. Yeah, wow. It's amazing when I get things right. But thank you so much for coming back. I know we kind of left you hanging yesterday because of the stories about the group that's kidnapping these young women who are pregnant and then forcibly removing their babies from their stomachs and then murdering them.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask Katarina, because I read some articles about this. Is there a central person that's arranging these? How do the bad guys know which women to pick?
Okay. So this is a ring and a lot of people were involved. So unfortunately, only one person has been charged for this. Marta Alicia La Diabla. But there were multiple people. So essentially what was happening was La Diabla, her husband and her son are in jail. They were luring the women, the victims, over Facebook profiles, okay, being like, romantic, catfishing them. And that's how kind of kidnappings have been going for a while now. Typically, though, they were luring men for extortion and using some fake hot girl Facebook profile. But then they started offering these women money or easy cash jobs or to be in a relationship. And La Diabla was responsible for going and picking these women up. Once these men in the jail set a meeting date, La Diabla would go pick them up. She had some other young girls working for her, like teenage girls. And they would pick up these women, take them to a house, video call a nurse to explain how to do the C-section, take out the baby, and then kill the women. And then an American man would pick up the baby, was responsible for transferring the money from the American buyer to La Diabla, and then pick up the baby and drive the baby into El Paso to the buyers.
What? How much were they paying for a child?
250,000 pesos. So let me do the math really quick. I forget in USD. 50 divided by, what's it at, like 20? So around like $12,000.
Wow. And that's the, oh my gosh. And the poor, what was the name of the poor lady that was murdered that you told us about yesterday?
Leslie Carrillo. There were two other women as well, but Leslie Carrillo is the famous and public case here. Mm. And La Diabla is charged with her murder.
I think I saw on one of your social media posts where you actually drove by the house where the murder was committed.
Yeah, I have a photo of it I can show you. So this house, the House of Horrors, actually was where Leslie's body was found. There you guys go.
Got it. Yeah, that little greenhouse.
Yeah. Her body was found semi-buried. And then, of course, there were, bloody gloves and tools. And unfortunately, no DNA evidence was taken from that crime scene.
You're kidding.
I'm not.
Is it because they don't have the training or they're just lazy or?
It's corruption.
I should have
known. This, the orders for this were being sent by CG&G, Jalisco New Generation Cartel. which Mexican authorities are not saying that. They're saying it's by La Línea, a cartel that operates in Juarez. And I'm under the impression and told by a lot of very high-level people that it's because there is such a high level of corruption within the Chihuahua state government with ties to CJNG.
And for our listeners who are not aware, Ciudad Juarez is right on the border with El Paso, Texas. Mm-hmm. It's I went the very first time I went down there, the police chief from the University of Texas, El Paso, gave me a tour of the city. And he also showed me on the campus where there are actual bullet holes in some of the campus buildings because stray rounds come across the border. Because if you ever go there, you can explain it better than I do, but it's a war zone every night.
Yeah. I mean, it's not so aggressive and blatant right now, but Juarez went through a time where it was like Afghanistan.
Wow.
In some areas, it still kind of looks like it.
Mm-hmm. I know when you're on the El Paso side and you can look across the border, because there's that valley there where the river is, or that creek, whatever they call it. You can see flashing lights all over the city, blue lights and red lights flashing everywhere. You actually hear the gunshots. And I hope it has calmed down some, because it was horrific. It's, you know, you wanted to be careful where you went out in El Paso because the rounds are coming across the border.
Yeah.
So CJNG. All right. Are there other cartels participating in that? Have you heard of any others, or is it just straight out CJNG?
This particular ring, what was going on, there were contacts in La Diabla's phone with CJNG. Now, she claims that she was with La Línea, and publicly Mexican law enforcement or politicians are saying it's La Línea. But sure, there's an alliance between La Línea and CJNG. So we are looking at the sort of big dog here that's sending these orders, that's running this profit up. There's a lot of groups that operate in Juarez. So it kind of complicates having to explain this to people and their reporting. But this particular operation is linked back to CJNG, and NCTC actually ended up saying that in their communication.
If you would just tell everybody what La Línea is.
La Línea is one of the cartels that operate in Juarez. Now, what a lot of people, I guess, don't know is that there's a lot of fragmented groups in Juarez. There's the Juarez cartel, there's La Línea, there's Nueva Empresa, Vieja Escuela, and then there's the Sinaloa cartel operates there. So it's a show, essentially, okay? And it got to a point where actually one of my, a U.S. Marshal I know said one time Mexican law enforcement called them and was like, who's in charge right now? They're like, what do you mean? They're like, what are the cartels right now? And they're like, you're the one supposed to be giving us that intelligence, not us to you. You guys are in Mexico. But that's just how bad it is, honestly, and how complicated, and how it's just constantly changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the United States has the El Paso Intelligence Center right there on Fort Bliss that does an excellent job. You know, mm-hmm. And I'm tooting DEA's praises, but multi-agency, and I think DHS is the big dog right now everywhere, especially under the current administration. There's other things that you talked about in some of your social media posts, not just human trafficking and drug trafficking and where they're stealing these babies and murdering people, kidnappings, extortion, disappearing families. Is all of that cartel related as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Mexico has a huge problem with disappeared people who have been missing for years. And, you know, it's unfortunate because a lot of the time law enforcement will chalk this up to, well, to the families, they'll say your son or your daughter or whoever is missing was working with organized crime. And, you know, I like to kind of say organized crime is a spectrum. You know, you can be like a low level drug dealer, but you can also work your way up those ranks. And I think for a lot of people too, it's wrong place and wrong time. There's also a femicide problem in Mexico, and particularly in Juarez, actually, where just, you know, for being a woman, someone wants to rape and kill you or live out some sort of demented sexual fantasy. And because of such a high level of impunity in the country, these people know that they can get away with it. They can do these evil acts. Whether they have to pay someone off or not is up to whatever happens to them. But for the most part, they're getting away with it.
It's just out of control, isn't it?
Yeah, honestly, it is.
You know, it seems like since Felipe Calderon was the president in Mexico, I mean, there was a lot of enforcement going on under his administration. The, I forget who the guy was, Peña, I think, Peña Nieto. He was next, and I don't remember a lot about him, but then AMLO came along.
And AMLO completely did a 180 from Felipe Calderon's approach. Felipe Calderon was very much like, let's fight, right? And it was like, Mexico was like a war zone, for real. And then AMLO came in, and he's like, hugs, not bullets policy, which basically meant, let the cartels take over the country. So there was less collateral, but then the shadow government became the government. And that is carrying on now into Claudia Sheinbaum's presidency. AMLO endorsed her, and she's never publicly explicitly said hugs, not bullets, but her approach mirrors that. I think a lot more has been done regarding cartels during her presidency, but I think that's because of the U.S. administration strong-arming the Mexican federal government. It's very complex. You know, like anytime I get into this, there's so many parts and they're all moving. So the way cartels are operating in Mexico right now is unprecedented. We haven't seen something like this before, where they are literally controlling everything and everyone, which is why the U.S. is sanctioning so many Mexican politicians. And that's also a first, seeing so 50 go down at once from the municipal level to the federal level. And that certainly is sending a message. And in my opinion, when you have politicians who are on the payroll, it's worse than the very criminals who are inflicting violence against communities.
Absolutely.
Because the politicians are the ones who, like we talked about previously, are supposed to uphold integrity and implement policy that protects citizens, not allows them to be terrorized at every waking moment.
Right. When I was at one point in my career, I was assigned to DEA Special Operations Division, and I was in charge of the Mexico Central America section. It was a headquarters position, but we were meeting, we were flying down to Mexico City and on a regular basis and having meetings with the government there. And Garcia Luna was the, I don't know if you remember that name, but he was the attorney general at the time. And we were warned that, you know, potential corruption, nobody wants to say it out loud, but it's the truth. And then the man retires and moves to the United States and buys a multi-million dollar property in Miami and thinks there's nothing wrong with that.
I know.
And he's now in federal prison here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what an idiot. It's oh my gosh. Like he's going to make that kind of money working for the government of Mexico.
I think that these people, because they can get away with it for so long while they're in Mexico, it boosts their ego to a point where they feel invincible.
Yep.
So then that's when they start making mistakes.
Yeah. And yeah, that's, I mean, I'm glad he did. Welcome to the United States. What's your opinion about the disappearing families down there? Because the government comes out with such low numbers, but then when you talk to people that know what's going on, they say the numbers are actually five times what the government's reporting, things like that.
Yeah, the official numbers are a load of, there are so many people missing in Mexico. And you just go into any, honestly, for any viewer, go to a Facebook group started by a mother whose son went missing in 2012. And you will just see the sheer amount of people who are looking for someone in their family. And when I was in Culiacán, Sinaloa, after the U.S. kidnapped El Mayo, I went over there because the civil war broke out. And of course, missing people was on the rise again. And so I spoke to a woman whose son had gone missing, I think almost a decade ago. And there were so many of these collective groups looking for missing people. And they're vilified by the cartels, obviously, because the cartels don't want these people sticking their noses in places they don't belong. But they're also vilified by the federal government. So recently, earlier this year, a ranch was found nearly 60 kilometers outside of Guadalajara, the Rancho Isaguirre. And it was literally an extermination camp. There were hundreds of personal belongings found and missing people who were tied to likely have been there. And it was found because, well, months before in the fall, the National Guard had been there and they allegedly saved kidnapping victims and arrested organized crime members and then left this ranch. A collective group of mothers who search for missing people were tipped off about this ranch. They end up going there and revealing to the press everything that indicated that this was an extermination camp and kidnapped people were there. And when that came out, the cartels were pissed off, saying, CJ was saying this wasn't us, because everyone was saying it was CJ&G. It was. CJ&G put out a whole press release. The main guy speaking said, "I'm a father. I would never do something like this." It's like,
right.
Like, shut up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the federal government also said, these mothers should not be going and doing this, and they're falsifying evidence. And it's like, you can't vilify them just because they're doing a job that you're not. You also shut up. So these women are very brave. And, oh, some of the women who actually found this camp were actually murdered afterwards.
Wow. I don't know who's more brazen, the people that run CJ&G and the other cartels or the government, into thinking that everybody else in the world is stupid.
The government. It's so
they lead the way, huh?
Yeah. It's such a slap in the face. But, you know, I feel I really have a soft spot for a lot of these people who are suffering due to organized crime, because it's just one thing after another. For example, I have two good examples from both governments too. Okay. In Sinaloa, you have these people who are, their livelihoods are absolutely destroyed. Their lives, in a lot of cases, the government does nothing to help them. And then the U.S. says, well, we're going to designate these guys as FTOs and we're going to prosecute all of the people involved. And people in Mexico are happy about that. Finally, at least some government is doing something for us.
Right.
And then the U.S. lets in 17 members of El Chapo's family to come live safely in the U.S. It's just like one blow after another. The U.S. puts out this huge, you know, press release and conference. We captured La Diabla, and thanks to our Mexican counterparts, and this ring is done. Never once mentions that the people buying these babies were Americans. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we prosecuting those people? And then the U.S. embassy in Mexico contacts one of the victims' mothers, and she's like, okay, I think that they're going to give me asylum. And she's horrified. After the case about Leslie came out, her family was being extorted horribly. And then she's like, I'm going to get asylum. No, doesn't get that.
And they just dangled it in front of her and then did give it to her.
Yeah. And then Mexico does absolutely nothing for this family. So, you know, you are collateral victim of organized crime. And nobody helps you. But we're going to crack down and we're going to end these criminals. We're going to designate them FTOs. And then you have the Mexican president saying, or even a lot of governors saying, it's not really that much of a problem, okay? And we're not going to designate them as terrorists. Imagine if you're living there, a country with a beautiful culture, by the way, and something absolutely life-altering happens to you and there's nowhere to go for help or resources. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. And that's why I try to get a lot of my reporting to reflect that. And a lot of people say, oh, you try to paint Mexico in a bad light. No, I don't. And the victims who I talk to and who talk to me and give me information, they would never say that.
And they appreciate you, somebody telling their story.
It's the least that can happen to them.
Wow. Who's the biggest, in your opinion, who's the biggest criminal cartel in Mexico right now?
CJNG. They're the first cartel to have power over all 32 states in Mexico.
Wow.
And they don't even touch fentanyl. They traffic meth, humans, cocaine.
Gee, well, who's doing the meth? Just Sinaloa?
The fentanyl is Sinaloa.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I've had another guest on here who has predicted that eventually CJNG will take over all the other cartels, will consolidate them. What's your opinion?
They're already doing that because, I mean, they are masters of absorption. They will absorb smaller mafias operating within Mexico. And then also, when a cartel is failing or needs help, they're the first to form an alliance and provide the manpower, the firearms and the funds. So as the civil war is going on in Sinaloa, the Chapitos faction was losing. So CJNG steps in, forms an alliance with Los Chapitos, which is basically a ploy to absorb the Sinaloa cartel.
All right. Because that, when I posted a lot of things on social media about that particular guest, I get a lot of comments from south of the border about that guest doesn't know what they're talking about. They don't have current information and all kinds of things.
No. If they're saying that CJNG is going to be or isn't already the head honcho and absorbing all these groups and aligning themselves with major cartels, they're right. That's right on the nose.
Yeah. And this particular individual is somebody that was a former police officer in Mexico that lives here in the U.S. but continually goes down there to get information.
Ed Calderon.
There he is. You know Ed?
Not personally.
So, you mentioned a while ago when you were talking about the U.S. kidnapping El Mayo. It was interesting how you put that. How do you come up with that conclusion?
Because it was a ploy between the U.S. government and their snitches, their informants within the Chapitos to set him up and get him into the U.S. He was also the one major narco who went the longest in Mexico without ever being captured.
Right. I know that was a really, really big deal.
It was a big deal. And you know what's unfortunate, though, is it ended up with inflicting a lot of violence in Sinaloa. It sparked a whole civil war, and nothing was done about that, you know? And that's why I'm not a big fan of the kingpin strategy. We talked about that in my episode. And it also opened this door for CJNG to basically access more power.
Right. How would you approach taking down CJNG or getting them under control? Have you ever?
I don't know. I give the same answer every time because it's the truth. It's you just have to target the financial pipelines, and a lot of CJNG's financial pipelines are in the United States, whether that be through selling stolen crude oil to American refineries, trafficking humans to Americans, laundering money through the U.S., shell companies, remittance services, major banks. That's the hardest way to go about it, but that would be the most effective. Because without money, there's no power and no capacity to do anything.
You know, and anybody who's been involved in investigations know you always follow the money.
Always.
That's why they're in business.
Yeah. And that's why they do this.
Right. It's just horrendous the way they're doing it. Just briefly, seeing that you're Canadian, what about drug trafficking organizations in Canada? Who are they?
There's a lot of ties with the cartels now, and that started with BC Bud because we had the best marijuana. And so the Sinaloa cartel caught wind of that. Canadian organized crime groups started trafficking this to them through California. You know, it's all along the Pacific coast. And a lot of their U.S. counterparts were providing arms to Canadian organized crime groups because we can't have guns in Canada.
Right.
So that was a big thing for them. And there are some major groups with ties to transnational, particularly there's a lot of South Asian Indian gangs in Canada that work with the cartels. And then the Chinese also, there's quite a few over there. There's, Brothers Keepers, United Nations, Red Scorpion. I'm missing some, but they're very connected transnationally, and it makes sense because operating in Canada is very easy. There's not a lot of law enforcement attention, not a lot, enough resources, the proximity in a lot of major cities to the border, major port entry in Vancouver, where a lot of the fentanyl precursors have been coming in. And the cartels sent some members up there to Canada where they were working with local organized crime groups so they could access the precursors, produce fentanyl, and traffic it into the U.S. and then disperse it throughout their networks. So Canada's a major player in the game. There's not a lot of public outrage or information about this. But I've been to these labs. I've spoken to these individuals. You know what? You can't deny what you've seen with your own eyes. And yeah, there's just not a lot being done about it. I mean, it seems as though it's kind of picking up from the U.S. side that they kind of want to do something about it. But domestically in Canada, not a lot.
You know, and it was, I think that was a very savvy move on the parts of the Mexican cartels. Because they're always looking for new routes to bring drugs into the United States. So, you know, the security on the south border versus the north border of the United States is much different.
It's completely different. There's nothing in common with those two borders. And people ask me that a lot. You know, what is the commonalities? There's none. The southern border, especially now, is also very tight, whereas the northern border is essentially wide open. So it was a great business move for them to move operations into Canada, because to get stuff into the U.S., simple.
So the conversation that you and I had yesterday on your show, we were talking about what's going on recently involving Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico, the narco boats that are being blown out of the water. Just, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know that I am. Give us your thoughts about that, because it's like I told you yesterday, I'm not disappointed by what's going on. I think this is the first real efforts from the whole of government of the United States to participate in a war on drugs, because we've had that term around since the early 70s. And like I mentioned to you, we're going after Pablo Escobar, the world's first narco terrorist, and they sent two guys down there. I mean, it's just ridiculous that you would even consider that a war. So let's talk about that, because you got good ideas.
Well, here's my issue with it, right? I agree with you in the sense that when the U.S. is targeting these cartels, they need to target the entire hierarchy, right? Not just the kingpin. You got to start from the bottom and work all the way through. However, we do not know who these people are. We don't have names. We don't have affiliations. And that will always spark criticism from me because I want to know who's being killed. And these are people who have had no trial. There's no charges. These are assumed, they're, you know, under suspicion that they're drug traffickers. But there's nothing that at least the public is being given to know for sure who they are. And I have an issue with that because that's when a lot of collateral can happen at the same time, right? Because how do we know that there are no human trafficking victims aboard these vessels? How do we know that every single one of these vessels is smuggling drugs? That's my take on it. Everyone is disagreeing with me, which is fine. I understand where people are coming from. I just think that there needs to be some level of law and order when conducting this, especially when we're talking about life or death.
If it's like we discussed, you know, I feel pretty sure that our intel community is collecting information that is, that's the basis of attacking these boats. And I want to believe, and I do believe that, you know, it's like we discussed those boats, you see how many motors are on the outboard motors. Those are $60,000 to $90,000 outboard motors. Fishermen don't have those kind of things. They don't have the big open, they do have open bow boats, but not the ones that have 3 and 4 high power engines on them. You don't see any fishing rig hanging off the sides. You don't see canopies on the boats.
I don't think as of right now, any of the boats that were struck were fishing boats. It's just there's a large number of people on board, and I just don't know who they are. And if I don't know, then I can't say, oh, yeah, drug smuggling boats.
If the United States, and I hope they never do, but if they were to release intelligence information as to how they confirmed those are boats with specific details, would that change your mind about it?
Of course. Of course. Even if we had names, this individual operating for this cartel was killed in the strike on that marine vessel.
Are the names available for the Colombian survivor and the Ecuadorian survivor from the semi-submersible?
Not that I've seen. I haven't actually checked lately, but not that I've seen.
I checked just a few days ago and I still can't find the names.
Yeah. I think I checked like maybe, yeah, earlier this week and no.
And from a semi-submersible, I'm pretty sure those are drug dealers because there's really no legitimate use for one of those.
So, of course, this is, I want to make it clear. Some of these boats are definitely smuggling boats. But there, and we've seen it before with American warfare, there is a margin of error. And right. So that's where I have an issue.
Off on just a little bit of a tangent, another tangent, but I don't want to waste a lot of time on it. The involvement of Venezuela and Maduro, are you getting any information on that as it relates to Mexico?
Okay. Venezuela has never been, of all the countries involved in drug trafficking, okay, Venezuela is the underdog. You have Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Mexico. These are the hot spots of where drugs are being produced, trafficked, and you have major capos. Venezuela is not. And I know that Maduro, you know, Cartel de los Soles, his involvement is, you can't refute that. But what I was shocked was that these strikes started in Venezuela, because that led me to believe this is more about a regime change and maybe something else, maybe oil. You know, I know that Venezuela's crude oil is not great, but there are some regions near Venezuela in the Caribbean that do have great crude oil. And so starting in Venezuela, and now we're only seeing a strike in Mexico, I actually thought it would be the other way around. I was under the impression, especially since the FTO designation, that strikes and boots on the ground and whatever, textbook warfare, was going to start in Mexico. And the USS Gravely was docked in Veracruz pretty shortly after the FTO designation happened. nothing really came of that. And when these strikes, four strikes off the coast of Acapulco the other day, it was 400 nautical miles off the coast of Acapulco. And the margin for, like, I guess, international waters is 200 miles off. So this is all very much planned to a T. I would love to know why Venezuela and not Mexico.
Good question. I don't know. I think the attention to Mexico may be coming.
It is. It certainly is. And it started with this Acapulco strikes. But it was odd to me that it was switched. I'm not saying that I want strikes in Mexico. You know, that's up to the viewer to decide whatever they want. It's just from my standpoint and reporting on this and living and breathing all of this information for the past few years, it kind of didn't align with the way that this administration has been targeting the cartels.
Right. So for our listeners here, you know, you're hearing two opposing views on what's going on, and we both encourage you to do your own research. Do your research. Don't just watch it on TV. Go do some research on these topics, and you decide what's right and wrong. Okay. We're not telling you what to think here, and we never will. You've got a brain. You figure it out. Yep. And I know Katerina's time is limited here. I just want to ask a couple more questions, and then we'll finish this up. Do you see yourself continuing to focus on North, Central, and South America in your journalistic activities for the near future or distant future for that matter?
I'm actually expanding coverage. So, you know, we see how transnational organized crime is global. And so over the next couple of months, my coverage will reflect that.
Great. And where do you see yourself in 5 to 10 years from now?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, because if you asked me 5 years ago, I definitely would not have imagined this. But hopefully in 5 to 10 years, my stories are stronger than they've ever been. And I have the capacity to dive deep on everything that matters. And I would ideally in some way like to be able to give back to affected communities that I cover as well. Yeah. And hopefully still alive.
Yeah. We hope so too. You're doing some public speaking events also, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of conferences have been reaching out to me to speak to them, particularly law enforcement conferences. Which was funny, because when I went to, ICGIC or ICGC?
SCGC.
That's what it was?
No,
it
wasn't. Southern California.
No, that's in the spring. The previous one I just did, it was.
You were in Arizona, I think. Arizona Gang Investigators Conference?
So, yeah.
Is that right?
I hope whoever's watching this doesn't get upset
about this. That's okay.
But yeah, and it was just so funny, because I mean, I don't really talk to police like that. So I don't know. It was so different for me. But it's a good learning experience, and I like being able to share my information, especially with people whose actions actually contribute or impact these very topics.
Very good. Well, a question is, after you spoke at that conference in Arizona, did people come up and ask questions?
They did. Nobody raised their hand during the Q&A.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I was bombarded with questions after I got off the stage.
It's my old DEA partner and I bet we've spoken at over 100 law enforcement conferences in the United States. It's the same everywhere. They will not ask questions in front of their friends.
No, they won't. And then after I got off stage, people were like, hey, just a question for you. I'm like, you guys had a moment for this.
Yeah. But see, the point of that is you have piqued their interest.
Yeah.
You know, so that you are reaching your audiences.
Yeah.
So here at the end, any last words of wisdom or advice that you would offer for anybody, maybe especially young people that are considering a life career in journalism or just anything? Final thoughts.
If you want to do something like this, you have to be willing to jump all in. This is not a dip your toe in the water type of career. It honestly is more of a lifestyle, and you give it your all and put your own desires, well-being, whatever it may be, a little bit to the side and focus on the nature of the job. And to be a critical thinker, that applies to everyone. You know, don't judge people and try to get as much information as possible in order to form an opinion, and always be open to accepting more information and learning and understanding different nuances, especially if you're really passionate about what your opinion is or the topic that you're discussing or learning about. And knowledge is power. Never stop learning. That's the key to life, honestly.
You know, you and I think a whole lot more alike than you would imagine. I used to tell people in the job when they're working for me, when you think you know it all, I want your transfer papers or I want your retirement papers, because if you're not willing to learn something new, you're going to get yourself or somebody else hurt.
I agree. Yeah. Always be willing to learn and adapt. Yeah.
Do you ever see yourself as like a wartime correspondent?
Would love to. Yes.
What the heck's wrong with you, girl?
I love that. A lot of the journalists that I've looked up to over the course of my career and previous to becoming a journalist, the ones that inspired me were war correspondents.
Yeah. I think I saw on your LinkedIn page that you follow Poppy Harlow.
Yeah. And I love Clarissa Ward. And you know, it's funny, a lot of these war correspondents that I look up to have made mistakes. They've gotten it wrong. But the way they come back from that and their reporting really speaks for itself. And so I respect that even more. I would like to be a war correspondent for sure. That's actually what I've always wanted to do.
I believe if anybody can achieve that, it's you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I really do. I say that with 100% sincerity. So ladies and gentlemen, you got to check out Katarina's podcast. It's called Borderland Dispatches.
Yep.
You can find it on YouTube. She's associated with Ironclad, which I think is your media group. Is that right?
The production company. Mm-hmm.
Who, they've got some fantastic people on there. If you want to find her on social media, on YouTube, I just told you, the Ironclad Borderland Dispatches, her podcast, Borderland Dispatches, Instagram, Katarina, and her last name is spelled S-Z-U-L-C, which is why I have a hard time saying it. On X, it's the same. Say again.
Everyone has a hard time with that.
Yeah. It's the same on X, Katarina Schulz. On LinkedIn, it's Katarina Schulz. I didn't see you on Facebook or TikTok. Do I have that right?
I don't use Facebook. I have a TikTok. I don't use it. I also don't use LinkedIn. I didn't remember I had LinkedIn.
Okay. Yeah. Cause your numbers in LinkedIn don't even come close to what you have on Instagram and, on X.
Yeah. I'm Instagram, X, and YouTube for the most part.
Do you have a website?
No.
And do you have plans to write a book?
Yeah.
Good. When you do, I don't know how far down the road, I may be dead by then, but if you come out and I've still got this podcast going, I will support you 100% on that. We'll help you get the word out.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So seriously, this has been a true honor to have you on here. I think you're probably the first person that I've brought on like this that doesn't have a direct tie into, you know, sometimes the media and law enforcement can go head to head, and it's not an amicable relationship. But I love the fact that you're willing to listen to other opinions, that you're not hesitant to offer yours. That's how we all learn. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me and chatting about all of these topics. It was a pleasure, honestly.
I hope I surprised you a little bit. Well, did we?
Honestly. I wasn't expecting us to get along so well. Well, I knew we'd get along, but not to the extent where I'm like, very similar, actually.
Yeah. Well, I'm not like, you know, Mel and Santi out there in San Diego. I'm a decent guy. So, listeners, thank you so much for continuing to support us here on Game of Crimes and Murph in the Morning. If you haven't checked out our Patreon channel, come on over. It's patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We've got some cool things going on there. I just did an interview here not a week or so ago with Chris Feistel and Wes Tabor, and we were actually on Patrick O'Donnell's podcast, Cops and Writers. And he's given me the audio portion, so I'm going to post that over on Patreon for you folks to listen to if you haven't heard it already. We talk about what's going on in Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico, and the United States. So check that out. And in the meantime, thank you for continuing to come back. I don't know why you do, but actually I do. Because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's our game of crimes. God bless. See you next week.